Good morning, Creekside. My name is Paul. I'm one of the elders or pastors here at Creekside, and I spent yesterday helping take down a tree in Amity and was doing the climbing work, and I learned two things. One is sweet gum sap will stain your hands, and I am no longer 20 years old, so if it looks like I am shuffling around like an old man up here, you are not wrong, because I am definitely feeling it today. As Randy mentioned, we're going to be continuing our study in the Sermon on the Mount, so Matthew 5. Please, if you don't have a Bible, feel free to run out and grab one. We have them there in the back. If you don't have one at home, take it home with you. It's the Word of God. It's super valuable. You can also grab your phone, download a Bible app. I did realize during first service I have a wireless mic, so I can wander the room and see what you're actually looking at on your phones. So just a warning, I may call you out if you're playing Candy Crush or something. Just keep that in mind. But we'll be studying Matthew 5, and I have never served in the military. I get asked all the time if I've served in the military. I don't know if I just look like I have or act like I have or what it is, but I haven't. Several generations of my family have. My father and grandfather were in the Army, and then my son has joined the Marines, and my daughter is going to join the Navy at the end of summer when she turns 18. So we're learning a lot about what it means to be a military family. Now, my son is not a Marine. And you might say, well, didn't you just say he was? No, I said he's in the Marines, and there's a distinction. See, Grady is in the ROTC, and what that means, if you're unfamiliar, is you are dual enlisted. You're in the you're in the military, in my son's case in the Marines, but you're also at college. And so you're doing both your studies and your military stuff while you go through school. And then when you graduate, if all goes well and you pass all the qualifications, you will graduate and become an officer in the military. But until he passes officer candidate school, he has not earned the right to call himself a Marine. If you enlist, you have to pass boot camp. But once you have proven yourself capable, you have earned the right to call yourself a Marine. And once you are in, you have crossed over and your identity is forever changed. You will always be a Marine and part of a brotherhood. Grady and I were at the gas station a couple weeks ago. We were running some errands, and I was filling up, and there was an older gentleman that pulled in and was waiting his turn to fill up, and so he started talking to me, friendly guy. He had on an overshirt, but underneath on his T-shirt, I recognized the Marine Corps logo. So I asked him, "Oh, sir, are you a Marine?" Now, notice I did not say, "Did you used to be in the Marines? Or are you a former Marine?" Again, once you're a Marine, you are a Marine for life. And he brightened up, "Yeah, I served in the Marines for 30 years. I said, "Oh, my son just joined the Marines." And so he started talking to Grady, and he told him a little bit of his story. For those of you that are old enough, he was a general's aide for Norman Schwarzkopf. And so had this long military career, shared that with Grady, gave him some advice, asked some questions. There was this instant bond over the shared identity in the Marine Corps. And we find our identity in all sorts of things. It might be in your family or your job, your capabilities, your politics or talents. And identities are complex. They're made up of several layers. We all have these complex identities. But there will be some foremost pieces of your identity, what you would call your core. And it's how you see yourself and who you are and how you want the world to see you. And you know it's your core identity because it drives behavior. It affects how you live, what you value, and when pressure or temptation come, it will determine how you act and react to that, whether you will be restrained or accelerated in certain decisions. Now, another part of this is that humans are herd creatures. It is in our nature, and our identity will put us in with a like-minded group of folks, but at the same time, it will make us opposed to other groups of folks. So if you, and then you're expected to defend your group and oppose the other group. So if you cheer for the Beavers, you cheer against the Ducks. If you cheer for the Ducks, you probably have a traumatic brain injury and you should go seek medical attention immediately because there's something terribly wrong with you. But keep this in mind as we study today through our text that we're going to see that your identity is on display to the world. And it's going to put you with a group, and it's going to put you opposed to another group. And it's going to drive action. Our text is also a transition point in the sermon. If you haven't been with us through the past few weeks, Jesus has been teaching through a series of blessed folks. Blessed are these folks, and here is how they are blessed. Blessed are the peacemakers, so they before they will be called sons of God. There's this pattern to it, and there's eight of them. After our section, Jesus will turn to correcting thinking about the scriptures. He will say things like, you have heard it said, but here's the deeper or real meaning. For example, you have heard it said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Now, I had always thought of the Sermon on the Mount as this like series of true but disjointed messages, that like, there wasn't connective tissue between them. But as Steve worked through teaching through the Beatitudes, I think that we saw that there's actually a progression. They're not just separate. They build on one another. And you'll see that in our text today, that it actually does continue to build on that, and there is connection between them. So, if you'll stand if you're able, we will read. I'm going to start in verse 11 of Matthew 5. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. Lord, we thank you for your word, and as I confess to the first service, and I'll confess to these folks, that preparing for this sermon was a slog. It seemed like I had thoughts in my head, but I couldn't bring it to clarity. So Lord, we pray that you do so this morning, and I give you all credit for anything good that comes out of this morning. And Lord, help your word to instruct our lives and our hearts. In your name we pray, Lord Jesus Christ. Amen. Amen. You may be seated. So the Beatitudes that we went through, they lay this foundation for a believer. You're poor in spirit, and because you're poor in spirit, you mourn, and you're humble. And it works its all the way up to being persecuted. And there's eight of them. And then there's this shift that happens in verses 11 and 12. And two things happen, and one of them was probably obvious to you. The other one's a little more subtle. The first thing is that Jesus emphasizes the persecution. He doubles down on Beatitude number eight. The other thing that happens is there's a shift in language that happens. Up until that point, he was speaking kind of generally, blessed are the, and in verse 11, blessed are you. He gets very specific and very personal, and you'll see that continue into our message this morning. So Jesus tells the disciples that this faith that was displayed in the Beatitudes means that they have an identity now as followers of him. I've got an outline for the message. It's pretty simple. I didn't work terribly hard on this because it's a pretty simple text. But if you're the kind of person that needs a little help in this department, there you go. But Jesus tells them they have this identity, and he tells them in plain but pretty loaded language, as we'll see as we go through this. He says, you are two things. You are the salt of the world, he says there in verse 13. Now, the statement probably is a little confusing at first read if you've never encountered something like this before. Is that a compliment? Like, Curtis, when you were wooing Susan, did you look at her and say, hey, babe, you're salt? That, you know, you try something like that? Or what's the first thing you think of when you hear salty? Do you think of, like, food, like chips or fries? Do you think of the ocean? Josh, you served in the Coast Guard. Do you think of salty language? Mainly because of your wife, but I did ask permission to use his name. I didn't say I'd burn his wife down, but he said yes, so there you go. But, you know, we have this saying in our modern world, we still have this saying, oh, that guy is salt of the earth. And what we mean by that is, oh, that guy's reliable, or he's kind, or he's trustworthy, or he's humble. Like, is that what Jesus is saying, that now that we're followers of him, our days we're nice people? Let's unpack what's going on with salt a little bit, because I think like many gifts from God, we don't realize how important salt is. It's in everything, not just because we're Americans and we pour it into our food. It is in our food, but it's an essential mineral. We have to have it to live. It's in soaps and plastics and epoxies and cleaning products, glass, rubber, pharmaceuticals, de-icer. It's in all sorts of stuff. If it's not in it, a lot of it's, you know, it's used in the manufacturing process. So it's essential to our lives. And because we're no longer an agricultural society or even a manufacturing society, most of us aren't intimately involved in making our everyday products that we use all the time. So I think some of this might be lost on us, and I need to draw it out here. And I'm going to give credit where credit's due. As I was studying and thinking about how to frame what I'm going to go through, I came across this article by the Gospel Coalition. It's a great website. They've got a lot of good material on it if you want to check it out. But I found something kind of in line with what I was thinking, and it laid out this framing that I'm going to use for the rest of talking about salt. And so, shamelessly ripping off their work, but I'm telling you that I'm doing so, so it's okay. But in the ancient world, salt had five primary functions. It was used as a preservative, it was used in fertilizer, it was used in flavoring, sacrifice, and judgment. And we're going to go through all of those, but as I do, keep this theme in mind that kind of will help make sense of it as an overall picture, is that this world is a broken place, poisoned by sin. And our job as Christians in the world, because of that, it's barreling toward destruction, and our job as Christians is to be the brake and to slow that down. So, let's take a look at the first one, preservative. And this is where most of the commentaries I looked at focus, and for good reason, that salt was a critical element for food preservation in ancient times because they had no refrigerator, they had no canning set up. It was use it fresh or salt it and preserve it. And so they use it on meat and other food to keep it from rotting under the natural decay that's present everywhere in the world. As you look at our world, I think it doesn't take much looking around to see that there's a lot of rot, that there's lying and thieving and perversion and violence pretty much everywhere you look. And Christians as salt are about preserving what is good and staving off the rot. And that's promoting kingdom values wherever you are in life. Now, I want to point out here, this is not a political call to arms. Jesus did not say, vote salt into office and sit down and watch salt solve all the problems. What he said was, you are salt. This is day-to-day in your life trench warfare that you are to represent the Lord. He's calling his followers to be bold and interact with the world in a way that represents him. Speaking up against evil, valuing everyone as an image bearer of God, defending the weak and protecting the innocent. Use whatever influence you have in your life to speak the truth. Now, our world has a funny relationship with truth because they want to stick the word your in front of it, your truth. There is no such thing. You might have a perspective, you might have a memory, but truth is objective. And when we speak the truth, we're not speaking our truth, we're speaking God's truth. Now, I'm also not saying, hey, go to school tomorrow and start tattling on everyone. Billy's doing this wrong. That's not what I'm saying either. What I am saying is if you're in a conversation and people are talking some sort of foolishness in a way it's like, oh, and everybody agrees with this foolishness, we should be bold and we should be willing to speak up and say, you know, I actually don't agree with that. I think the Lord has something different to say about that. And preserve what is good. Salty Christians say salty things. Number two, fertilizer. It was known to the hearers of this sermon, probably not to us, they had a lot of animals, so guess what else they had a lot of? A lot of manure. And the manure was used as fertilizer, but to put it on the fields, you had to collect it somewhere and store it up and then go spread. So while it was being stored, they would put salt on the manure. And this did a couple of things. It kept it from rotting, which preserved the nutritional value in the manure so that when it spread on the field, that it would do its work. And it also kept the smell down. Jesus talks about this in a similar passage in Luke 4. And there's debate whether or not it's the same exact sermon or different sermons. It doesn't matter for our purposes this morning. In Luke 4, Jesus says, salt is good, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is of no use either for the soil or for the manure pile. It is thrown away. We need to recognize that we are called into a dirty, stinky world. Jesus says we're salt of the earth, not salt of the Bible study, not salt of the homeschool co-op, not salt of the Sunday morning gathering. Like, those are all good things, and Christians should get together and interact. We are called to be salt of the earth. That means you have to be of the world, in the world, not of it, to be effective. Don't want to get that wrong. You know, this world's a big mess to get involved in. In fact, kind of a bit disgusting. And Christians need to recognize that and be willing to get dirty, to bring God's blessing to the world, or at least keep the smell down a little bit. Salty Christians are willing to get into the muck. Flavoring is the one we're probably most connected to. Salt enhances other flavors, right? It makes eggs edible. It's veggies and fruit and baked goods and salted caramel. Like, it's all good. Makes everything better. Brings out nuance. It's like bacon. You know, bacon just improves everything. And pro tip, if you add bacon, you get salt and bacon all at once. So you can solve the problem right there. But in the same way, Christians can enhance the world around them. Paul tells us this in Galatians 5. The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such things there is no law. And there's no situation that we're going to run into in the world that cannot be improved by adding the fruits of the Spirit. The world around us sorely needs people that are willing to show the fruits of the Spirit and bring kingdom values to bear in the lives, and that pushes back on the values of this world. Salt makes awful food tolerable. It makes tolerable food good. It makes good food great. As we interact with this world, are we living in a way that we make awful situations tolerable? Someone's just going through something rough. Can we help them out of that? That we make tolerable situations good, that we make good situations great. Salty Christians make this world palatable. Number four, sacrifice. Again, lesser known to us, definitely known to the hearers of this original sermon, the law required salt to be offered alongside the sacrifice. In Leviticus 2, it says this, "You shall season all your grain offerings with salt. You shall not let the salt of the covenant with your God be missing from your grain offering. With all your offerings, you shall offer salt." Ezekiel 43 also talks about salt on animal sacrifices, but in this text, it references salt three times, in like one little section. I think that's because even in ancient times, people are distractible and spaced off during the talk, but like, it's obviously an important part of the sacrifice. It's critical to it. It represented God's covenant with his people. It completed the sacrifice, seasoning it and making it pleasing it to God. In a similar way, Paul exhorts us in Romans 12 to act as a sacrifice. "I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship." And to follow God requires us to live sacrificially. The reason I read those immediately preceding verses is it talks about part of that sacrifice. When we walk the Christian walk, when we identify ourselves with Jesus, it's automatically going to put us in opposition to this world, and we are going to be persecuted because of it. That requires sacrificial thinking. And I need to be clear. Like, look, Jesus is the sacrifice that heals the world. He paid the price for sin, sufficient for all, and I am not in any way suggesting any incompleteness in that sacrifice. What I am saying is when we live as salt, that salt layers on top of that sacrifice, representing the covenant between God and his people to this world. In a selfish, narcissistic, and self-absorbed world, salty Christians are a picture of God's sacrifice. And number five, judgment and destruction. Salt is often a sign of God's judgment in the Bible. I will give you a few examples. There are many more. In Deuteronomy 29, Moses warns of God's judgment that he will burn the land with salt and brimstone. In Psalm 107, the psalmist says God talks about God making a fruitful land into a salty waste because of the evil of its inhabitants. In Jeremiah 17, the prophet talks about turning from the Lord, placing one in an uninhabited salt land outside of God's blessing. And in Mark 9, Jesus talks about, "For everyone will be salted with fire." This maybe is a harder one to accept, and we don't like to talk about it. There are whole churches and denominations that are committed to God's love, but never want to talk about God's judgment because it's an unpleasant subject. But you can't have one without the other. Judgment is the result of opposing God. And this world is running as quickly as it can away from God and straight towards God's judgment. People need to know that there is a God. They need to know that they violated his justice. People you know are in this group. We are representatives of God's judgment, and we know this world is headed for destruction. The train is on the tracks. So when I was doing the tree job yesterday, we were in Amity, and the train came through, and you can hear it from miles away, and it kind of rumbles the ground, and they blow the horn, they cross it. It's not a secret the train's coming, right? When we think about judgment, think about it this way. We know the train's coming. And if we aren't serious about this, it's like we are sitting next to railroad tracks watching some children play on it, and we're like, I could do something about that. Or I could pop some popcorn and watch the show. We need to be careful here. Again, we're not the judge. It's not our job to to declare sentences upon people, but it is our job to be motivated by this reality, to bear the heart of God that takes no pleasure in the death of the wicked and bear witness to the judgment. Salty Christians are sober about judgment. The Gospel Coalition article I was talking about ends with this. Rather than assuming that Jesus' statement is confusing and then debating which particular use of salt he had in mind, it's best to assume he knew what he was talking about. Always a good assumption. Or knew what he was doing, and that the metaphors can function in multiple ways. Followers of Jesus are like salt. Although we're ordinary and everywhere and get involved in pretty much everything, whether we're noticed or not, we also have a variety of roles to play as God's kingdom comes on earth. After Jesus tells them they're salt, he also says this, but if salt has lost its taste, in verse 13, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. See, salt is beneficial, but it must be pure to be useful. It's got to be separate from the earth. If we were to go to lunch today at one of the beautiful wineries that's up and around McMinnville and Amity, and we got some lunch, we're sitting there, and you taste your food, it's a little bland. You wouldn't lean back and grab some dirt off the ground and sprinkle it on the food. You'd reach for the salt shaker. Salt and earth are separate. Similarly, just because it's a white crystalline substance doesn't mean that it's salt. The Dead Sea salts, the Dead Sea is this, the sea in the Holy Land, the Dead Sea salts contain bromide, what else is it? Magnesium and other minerals. It makes them bitter. Most of the Dead Sea salts are not actually useful as salt. And so there's a danger here that Jesus is worrying about. He's saying you can look like salt. You can feel like salt. But the proof is in tasting. The genuine article has a distinct flavor. The warning here is you can walk into church every Sunday, be helpful to your neighbor, volunteer at the shelter, send money to missionaries, and still be a useless white powder that can't even improve poo. Jesus' words, not mine. I just mixed them up a little bit. Your faith is a religious behavior, not a love of Jesus. Jesus himself, a couple chapters later in Matthew 7, says this, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. On that day, many will say to me, 'Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do many mighty works in your name?' And then I will declare to them, 'I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness.'" I'm willing to bet for most of us the name Charles Templeton doesn't mean anything to us. But I bet the name Billy Graham does. Billy Graham was one of the foremost evangelists in the United States. Led revivals in football stadiums and filled them. Charles Templeton founded that ministry with Billy Graham. Served alongside of him for many years. Preached himself to tens of thousands. You would have called him salt by all evidence. But after, I can't remember how many years, I think 5 or 10 years in the ministry, Charles Templeton walked away. And he ultimately wrote a book about why he rejected God. He became agnostic. He was a professor and did some other things. There's an interview late in his life that shows some evidence maybe of a changed heart, and I'm not a judge of Charles Templeton, but there's an example of someone who looked like salt, felt like salt, but wasn't salt. You know, unfortunately, you know, we're a big enough church that I think I can say with fair confidence, some of us need to realize that we're not salty and that we're living a dangerous lie. We think that we do good stuff, so God's pleased with us. Oh, I go to church, I go to MC, I help out here, I. Jesus doesn't say to us in this text, do works to prove you're salty in light. No, he says, you are salt and light, therefore do good works. If you're just jogging on a religious treadmill with no love of the Lord, take Jesus' warning that unsalty salt is good for nothing but be thrown out and trampled under feet. It's serious business. Martin Lloyd-Jones, he's a commentator Steve has quoted often as he's gone through the Beatitudes, says this in the commentary in this section. So often the tragedy has been that people proclaim the gospel in words, but their whole life and demeanor has been a denial of it. The world does not pay much attention to them. Jesus goes on in verse 14. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Jesus often talked about light. In John 9, Jesus says this, as long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. In John 12, he elaborates a little more. So Jesus said to them, the light is among you for a little while longer. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness overtake you. The one who walks in darkness does not know where he is going. While you have the light, believe in the light that you may become sons of light. What Jesus is saying here about light versus salt, it may be easier to grasp the light part of it than it was the salt, but it is profound. He has literally passed the spiritual torch to his people. And because of the incredible power of the gospel to change lives, our nature changes, and we become like the Lord as we go through life. I will say, though, maybe the illustration has lost some of its impact. Because in the ancient world, lighting wasn't common. It was expensive. When the sun went down, life shut down. We live in a world full of artificial light. If you've got a phone, you got a light on you all the time. And we came up with LED lights, so we've got lots of light. We've got light switches and reliable power, so wherever you go, I need light. Have you ever had the power go out in your house for the next 2 hours? You're an idiot walking around flipping on light switches going, oh yeah, power's out. 2 minutes later, oh yeah, power's out. We've just become so accustomed to power that we don't get the sense of what he's saying here, I don't think. A human eye can see a candle, one candle, roughly 2 miles away if there's no other light around. You know, a few years ago, I was backpacking with my kids. We were staying up at Malwich Lake. It's up in the High Cascades, right under Three Finger Jack. And there was a meteor shower. I'd like to say I was smart enough to have planned to be there for the meteor shower. It just worked out that way. And because we were up in the Cascades and away from all the light from Salem and McMinnville and all the cities around us, like, we had an incredible first row seat to this light show that was going on. And we stayed up for hours, way too late, watching this light show, and it was incredible. It doesn't take much light to shine in a dark place. And Jesus illustrates this with two examples. The first is the city on a hill. I don't know if you've ever been out of town where you can see just the glow of cities. We live up on the hill, so you can see like the glow of McMinnville and the glow of Amity and that sort of thing. But they do shine. In ancient times, like think of a shepherd out in the middle of a field. There's no other lights around because light's expensive. He could see the city for miles around. In fact, Jesus tells us in the text, it cannot be hidden. When you have the light of God, you shouldn't be able to hide it. It should be obvious to everyone around you. Whether they like it or not, it's another matter, but it should be obvious to them. The second example he gives is a household lamp. This is common. Everyone had them that had a home. And they're about the same light as a candle. They're these little clay vessels that had a reservoir for oil and a wick, and they'd put out a little flame about that long. And Jesus makes this ridiculous statement. He said, no, you don't take that and put it under a basket. Well, first of all, that'd be a fire hazard, so that sounds kind of idiotic. But secondly, it's wasteful. Oil's expensive, you don't use much light, so it's dumb and wasteful to hide something so precious. No, he says, you put it on a lampstand where it can bless people and it can fill the house with light and you can see where you're going and not step on the ancient Legos that your kids left laying around. That's what you do with light. You don't hide it, you put it up high. He's reminding his hearers, look, hiding your light is wasteful and dumb to do with something so precious as the light of God. And God's light does two things. God's light exposes sin, and it serves as a beacon, shining forth to lead people out of darkness. Light gives hope. It also gets two reactions. In John 3, it says this, and this is the judgment. The light has come into the world, and people loved the darkness rather than the light, because their works were evil. For everyone who does wicked things hates the light and does not come to the light, lest his works should be exposed. But whoever does what is true comes to the light so that it may be clearly seen that his works have been carried out in God. Two reactions to the light. Either get opposition and hate, or people drawing near to God's love. And when we are light, we are having God's heart to show love to an oppressed people. And we're letting them know there's a way back. They do not have to live as an enemy of God. One more quote from Martin Lloyd-Jones. And I should have looked at when this book was written. It doesn't matter. This is true today as it was when it was written. The sole cause of the troubles of the world at this moment, from the personal to the international level, is nothing but man's estrangement from God. That is the light which only Christians have and which they can give to the world. Man has been made by God that he cannot truly live unless he is in the right relationship with God. And God has put certain rules in his nature, in being, in existence, and unless he conforms to them, he is bound to go wrong. That is the whole cause of the trouble. And so we arrive at the end of our text in verse 16, where Jesus tells them, in the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. Jesus tells them in the same way that light is most useful when it's elevated, like the city on the hill or the lamp on the stand, to let their light shine in the dark in front of witnesses. When I was a kid, lasers were just starting to appear in society. They were this exotic, crazy thing that were just in laboratories, and you couldn't just go to the store and buy a $2 one to play with your cat, right? They were just starting to show up in movies and other places because they were hideously expensive. And I remember going to OMSI. They had this laser light show, which was like the culminating coolness of the world to go see in the dome these lights, and they'd make, you know, different creators and stuff. Who here has been to OMSI's laser light show? Yeah, wasn't that incredible? And because lasers were new and they weren't common, it was just like incredible, mesmerizing, bewildering spectacle to go see the laser light show. And that's what Jesus is saying. Our light should be like that, fresh and new and bewildering to this world, something mysterious and something that they haven't seen. And he says to the people should see your good works and then glorify God. There's some implications here. One, we should produce good works, right? And they should be good and admirable and serve the world that we live in. And two, people should see them. They should be conspicuous and known. Now, there should be something in pushing back right now in your mind, because you should have something going, didn't God also say not to do a bunch of stuff in front of people? Yes, he did. One chapter over in Matthew 6, Jesus warns them, beware of practicing righteousness before others in order to be seen by them. For then you have had your reward, and you shall receive no reward from your Father who is in heaven. pretty key distinction. Why are you doing the good works? Is it because you want your glory or you want God's glory? See, there should be no self in the glory of good works. If we go back to the Beatitudes, what was the first one? Blessed are the poor in spirit. When we remind ourselves that we really bring nothing to the Lord, then we don't get all excited about proving how great we are when we go do good works, because we had nothing to bring. It's a circular reminder to have the right heart, and we should return to it from time to time. And remember that this light that we're shining, that also belongs to the Lord. So he's the one that should get the glory for it. The Beatitudes, as we go back through them, you know, they're more about the heart that we need to have. They're not an achievement. It's not a list that you can go through and check off, yeah, I got that one, yeah, I got that one. Oh, hey, I made it to the end. Yay me. I'm done for life. Because our hearts are corrupted, and we'll return to bad habits, and we'll return to old ways, and we need to remind ourselves, I need to be poor in spirit. I need to come back to that place where the Lord is the one that gets glory, not me. So we're called salt and light in these verses. And these things share some characteristics I want to point out to you that I think are important, that are belong to both of them. Both are in contrast with everything around them. Salt has a distinct flavor. You might taste some food and you're like, I'm not sure. They put nutmeg in this? Or, you know, sometimes we can't tell quite. Salt is not one of those things, right? You can tell if something's salty or not. Everyone can tell if something is salty or not. You're not confused about it. Similarly, light is very different from darkness. If you've ever had to fumble around in pure black, you know that a little bit of light can go a very long way. That light and salt are distinct from the world around them. They're also both very powerful. It doesn't take much salt to alter a dish. Like I said about being in the dark, it doesn't take much light to improve on pure darkness. And in this, we need to remind ourselves, like, we're carrying God's light. You literally have the power of God available to you when you carry that light. That it is a powerful thing. Salt and light cannot be ignored. Finally, they both alter the world around them. Life in their absence would be terrible. Imagine for a moment, we don't have any salt. Doesn't exist. Eating wouldn't be a whole lot of fun. Or our power grid has gone down permanently. We don't have any more light. The absence of those things would be terrible. And the instant you introduce salt or light, there is a measurable difference in impact. That as we live our lives, salt and light should make things happen. And both are important, right? One, salt is more in line with like God's justice, and light is more in line with like God's mercy, and both things are needed. Justice and mercy meet on the cross. We sing that song sometimes, and that is the element of God that we need to enjoy both of those things, because one or the other, being higher, gives a distorted view of God. And just by our nature, like, we're probably going to tend to be more salty, or we're going to tend to be more light, we're going to tend to be more like about getting things right, or we're going to tend to be more merciful. And kind of examine your own heart in that and think about, what is it that God would want me to grow in so that I am both salt and light as I go about my daily life. I'll go ahead and call the worship team back up as I'm finishing here. But as we live out our identity as distinct and powerful impact, and remember it's for God's glory, I'm just going to offer this, that just like becoming a Marine, Christians, when they become a Christian, are changed forever. You become part of a brotherhood that will forever change your identity. The difference is we didn't have to earn it. It is a free gift of God. And in light of that, I have two questions for you that I want you to think about this week. Number one, what if you believed Jesus? What would it look like if you believed the Lord when he told you, I have made you the very thing this world needs right now? It needs salt. It needs light. You are salt and light. I think sometimes we get caught up in our own, feelings of inadequacy or whatever we let hold us back. We need to remember that God has changed our identity, and in him we have power. Number two, what would it look like if you shared God's love for people? Right before our text, and part of the reason I read those two verses preceding our text, Jesus tells them they're blessed when they're persecuted. Then he goes on to tell them, you have a new identity in me, and because of that new identity, you should do good works. There's a pretty good chance, if you're living your life out in the world, your good works are going to bless the very people who are the persecutors. And that's the heart of God, to love those even when they don't love you, because that's what God did for us. What would it look like if you shared God's love for people? Mark?